Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Joe Epstein, a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for the program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android apps for programs and schedule information as well as podcasts of past programs. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Lanny Davis, former legal counsel to President Bill Clinton and the author of the new book, Crisis Tales, Five Rules for Coping with Crisis in Business, Politics, and Life. Lanny Davis has had an amazing public career as a lawyer, a consultant, an author, and a television commentator. And it's difficult to say who his most famous client was, but why don't we start with his role as legal counsel to President Bill Clinton. Some of the issues in the Clinton White House had to do with campaign finance investigations and, oh yes, the Monica Lewinsky affair and the subsequent impeachment trial of the president. Lanny also served on a five-member Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board of President George W. Bush. The client list of Lanny Davis is like a who's who in American public life. People like Trent Lott, Gene Upshaw, Martha Stewart, and recently the office of the president of Penn State University on the handling of the painful firing of 50-year coach Joe Paterno. Lanny Davis has had a remarkable private legal career as well. He was a partner in some of the most prestigious law firms in the country, including the D.C. office of San Francisco's Orrick, Herrington, and Sutcliffe. In 2009, he left Orrick to join McDermott, Will, and Emery, and subsequently, he formed his own company, Lanny J. Davis & Associates. Lanny Davis is currently a Fox News contributor, writes a regular column called Purple Nation, which, by the way, means bipartisan, and purple being the confluence of the colors red and green. His column appears in The Hill, The Huffington Post, The Daily Caller, and Newsmax. Lanny founded Purple Nation with Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee. He grew up in New Jersey, attended Yale University as an undergraduate, where he was chairman of the Yale Daily News. He also received his LLB from Yale Law School, where he won the Thurman Arnold Moot Court Prize and served on the Yale Law Journal. Additionally, while at Yale Law School, Lanny met two people who had a major impact on his career. In his undergraduate studies, he met George W. Bush, who Lanny claims hazed him at their fraternity, and I'll mention the name Delta Kappa Epsilon. He also met Hillary Rodham Clinton while attending Yale Law School. Lanny was the National Director of Youth Coalition for the unsuccessful Edmund S. Muskie campaign for the 1972 Democratic Party nomination for president. He ran unsuccessfully for the 8th Congressional District of Maryland, and he served three terms, 1980 to 1992, on the Democratic National Committee representing the state of Maryland. So please welcome the author of several books, including his newest book, Crisis Tales, Five Rules for Coping with Scandal in Business, Politics, and Life. Please welcome Mr. Lanny Davis.
Well, thank you. That was quite an introduction, and it's a great honor to be. I'm a little bit hoarse from watching my 14-year-old son play baseball with 45-degree temperature and winds in my face for a week down in Florida, of all places, where it was quite cold. But I hope, despite my hoarseness, you can hear the humility and honor I feel in being at the Commonwealth Club as a speaker and the people who preceded me. I just heard that Chris Matthews was here about his really great book on John Kennedy, and I mentioned that Chris and I go way back. We share something in common that perhaps people don't know about Chris, but they might know about me, as you heard in the introduction. I ran for Congress unsuccessfully. Well, so did Chris. But I also have, as predecessors at this platform, an amazing list of people, presidents of the United States, including two friends from my law school days, Hillary Rodham before she changed her last name and met the big guy. And then, of course, Bill Clinton. And an undergraduate, when I was at Yale, in my residential college, a very likable, somebody that I don't think anybody at Yale ever had a bad word to say about, George W. Bush, who I also voted for president for Delta Kappa Epsilon. But a man with a great heart, and somebody, despite my strong disagreement with him on a number of policies, to this day, I consider to be a great friend. So how is it possible I could be, as my 14-year-old son said to me when he was 11, Dad, how is it possible for you to be friends with both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush? And I guess I'm sort of the Forrest Gump of my generation. I went to college with not only George W. Bush, but somebody a year ahead of me who was running for the presidency of the Yale Political Union, John Kerry, actually won that race for president, and somebody who was the chairman of the Yale Daily News 3 years ahead of me, and I got to be friendly with him as I sought that office 3 years later, is Joe Lieberman, who ended up being the godfather of my oldest son. My first generation of children are older, have 3 children each, meaning I have 6 grandchildren, and I started a second round, so I now have a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old. Now, if you would like to hear the story of that crisis management, it would take a long time, but I'm very, very lucky to have this next generation of children and to be called the dinosaur by my 14-year-old because I hate the iPhone is the whole nother story. I love the iPhone. If you're listening, iPhone users, it's just that I can't do the things that my 14-year-old can do with his thumbs as quickly. So I wanted to talk a little bit about my days at the White House and how I learned this discipline of crisis management. It's not exactly a joy and a pleasure and a stress-free way to live, but I also was intrigued by an invention that I accidentally stumbled on in combining my legal background as a practicing lawyer and the great firm of Orrick, Herrington & Sutcliffe here in San Francisco. I was honored to be a partner for 6 years. But I also knew in the White House that you couldn't just look at the latest political or legal controversy President Clinton faced from a legal standpoint. The White House is a political institution, and reputation isn't always taken care of or repaired when it's being attacked in a courtroom. In fact, it's usually the worst place to rely on to repair a reputation. Because even in the days before the internet, and I want to address how things have changed today in a little while, but even before the internet, when your reputation is under attack, and if you don't have the ability to respond quickly, the repetition of a falsehood achieves a strength and validity so that people actually believe it to be true because it's repeated so many times. So when I was at the White House defending my friend Bill Clinton and there to also defend my friend Hillary Clinton on issues relating to Whitewater and campaign finance allegations, this was really pre the matter regarding Ms. Lewinsky, which occurred on my last days of my tenure. So those of you who saw me on television defending President Clinton from what I thought was an illegitimate impeachment effort, I was a volunteer for my friend. I'd already left and did most of my very stressful work as a volunteer. But my lesson at the White House was that you couldn't address protecting a reputation by just looking at the legal outcome. You had to look at a broader world where media creates the perception, where repetition becomes a surrogate for facts. And you had to learn to fight back with the facts in an effective fashion, to catch up to what, in my view, were falsehoods and distortions about President Clinton. When I started this job, just to lighten up a little bit. I really wasn't sure what I was getting into. I was in private practice, about to start a new family. My wife had then become pregnant with what is now my 14-year-old son, Josh. And I wasn't sure I was there for any other reason than try to defend my friend Hillary on what I thought were outrageous and baseless charges about something called Whitewater, and President Clinton as well. And then into the season after the 96 election, where Republicans saw an opportunity to hurt President Clinton about campaign fundraising. And I was there as a lawyer to try to explain why some of the campaign fundraising practices, while maybe not always beautiful to look at, were not all that different than what Republicans were doing. And that the real problem in our process is that both parties don't do a very good job of having high ethics when it comes to fundraising. And if we really wanted to change the system, you're now hearing me on the White House lawn with my message. This is what I would say. I would have a hard time defending some of the practices in fundraising that had occurred in the Clinton campaign. But I would say if you really want to change the system, we need campaign finance reform, transparency, limitations on contributions, and et cetera. And the problem with that is that President Clinton supports campaign finance reform. It's the Republicans criticizing him who oppose campaign finance reform. That was a good line, but it didn't change the facts that some pretty bad stories about what the Clinton campaign had done during the 96 campaign I had to deal with. So what do you do when you have bad facts? And you know that those bad facts are going to come out sometime. That's the challenge. And I learned very quickly that you cannot delete a bad fact. You cannot change the subject about a bad fact. The bad fact will come out sooner or later. So lawyers tend to hold bad facts back because when you're litigating a case, you hope the other side doesn't ask for a document that will hurt your client. If they do, you have to turn the document over. If they don't, you do not. But when you're in the White House or engaging in the crisis management tales that I, true stories that I tell in this book, from Martha Stewart to Charles Rangel to Trent Lott to Gene Upshaw, and finally the difficult challenge of dealing with the matter in Penn State, the first and primary judgment, which is a very human dilemma, is if you know bad facts, what do you do with them? Do you pick up the phone and call the other lawyer in a case and say, hey, I've got a document that really is going to hurt my client. Come on over and look at it. That would be unethical. I could lose my license to practice law if I did that. But let me bring you into the White House on a real occasion, not written in my book, where we had that decision. What do we do with this bad fact? We discovered in a box full of documents from the former White House chief of staff that had been subpoenaed by Senator Fred Thompson, then Republican senator from Tennessee. That's right, Law and Order Fred Thompson was a senator from Tennessee, a truly great man. And Representative Dan Burton, Republican from Indiana, had announced nationally televised hearings about campaign finance abuses in the 1996 Clinton campaign. So this is January, February 1997. The nationally televised hearings are scheduled for June. We knew every cable station round the clock would be covering these hearings. And I'm going through a box of documents that I know that Fred Thompson and Dan Burton and the Republican congressional staffers have in their possession. And we're just getting ready to see what they have. I come across a document that came from the Democratic National Committee, and it lists 10 people who have been very generous donors to the Democratic Party. And on that list are people whose name I recognize, who are great Democrats and very generous financially to helping the Democratic Party. And the note from the sender of this memo was to President Clinton, these 10 names need to be energized, great word, for the 1996 presidential campaign. Of course, I saw energized us or dollar signs, because the person writing the memo was a very big manager of the campaign fundraising operation, so I knew what he meant by energized. And then he said they should be invited to stay overnight in the Lincoln bedrooms. So you all remember that story in the vague memories of your bed dreams that I have about it. So we look at the document. On top of the document is President Clinton's handwriting, recognizable by how illegible it was, in his left-handed handwriting and a left-handed check mark indicating he'd read the document. And he said, let's move promptly, 100K, 50K, in his own handwriting. Now, I know what he meant was nothing different than any other president of the United States in his position. Let's invite a lot of our friends and supporters over. Let's thank them for all they've done for us with a thrill to stay overnight in the Lincoln bedroom. And then let's hope they'll be generous again. That was certainly one way of articulating what the president had in mind. Another way is the way that the Republicans on Capitol Hill, I knew, would describe that little note, which is, the White House under President Clinton was just another version of Motel 6. In other words, not very friendly and distorted, but nevertheless, a grain of truth. So what do you do with that document? Well, we could hope that they don't find it, but I knew they had it. We could wait until they disclosed it and then get ready to pounce back to correct what would be a distortion that this is all that unusual to invite generous people from your political party to stay overnight at the White House. Or you could do what I teach in my book, but actually practiced. And it's counterintuitive because, as I said, as a lawyer, if I did it, I would be doing something unethical by volunteering something that's adverse to my client. But in this case, the pathway was pretty clear. We knew that Senator Thompson would love this document and blow it up on the front pages of every newspaper and make all sorts of political accusations, as would Representative Burton. So knowing that, my decision, counterintuitive, was to preempt and get that story written now rather than wait. The mantra that I developed about doing that is about the truth. If it's a bad fact, as I said when I opened, that cannot be deleted. One way of dealing with a bad fact is tell it all, tell it early, tell it yourself. Don't wait for the other side to describe the bad fact in the worst possible way, even to distort it and use hyperbole about it. But do it yourself and maybe create a fact sandwich with a bad fact surrounded by good facts. So that is a lesson in crisis management that I learned on that particular occasion that I've applied since. So what did we do? I called a reporter. It was an Associated Press reporter. And I said, would you like to write a story about people staying overnight in the Lincoln bedrooms? And they were expected to give contributions to the Democratic National Committee to help the Clinton campaign. And the reporter said, I sure would. So we did what is called a leak in a technical sense. I was handing a reporter a document and inviting the reporter to write a nasty story. I called it a deep background private placement, meaning no attribution, here's the document, go write your story. But if you were I, would you just leave that story without context? Would you just hand that over to the reporter? No, we needed to create a fact sandwich and put that story in context. So the first thing we did is go to the White House archives and see who was invited to stay overnight in President Bush 41's White House, Bill Clinton's predecessor, and in President Reagan's White House, President Bush 41's predecessor. And we went to the usher who keeps the records of guests of presidents, And lo and behold, shocking, President Bush 41 invited lots of big donors to stay overnight in the Bush White House. They were also friends of his, as did President Reagan, even invited them to the East Room of the White House and openly said, "I'm glad you're here. Please keep helping the Republican Party," which was a direct pitch for money in the White House. So we did the homework and gave the reporter the total list of people who stayed overnight in the Clinton White House. After going through 700 or 800 names, we found most of them were Chelsea's friends, members of Congress, or members of the diplomatic corps. That's a great fact. And only a small number were donors. And then we found other facts about Ronald Reagan and George Bush. We gave all that to the reporter. He had all the time that he wanted to write the story. There wasn't a quick deadline. And then he gave me a chance to give him a quote, making the best of this situation. And I think my quote was something like, "Despite all that we did to raise money during the presidential campaign of 1996, the Republicans and the Republican Party outraised President Clinton by 4-1. Why did I choose that particular argument? That's all it is an argument. Is don't be so shocked that President Clinton wanted to, quote, energize his donors when no matter what he did, he was outspent by, in those days, a powerful Republican fundraising machine that Democrats could never compete with. So I've told you that story because the outcome was pretty bad story. Headline, President Clinton invites fat cats to stay overnight in Lincoln bedroom. His handwriting photographed on the front page of every newspaper. Not a very happy day at the White House. I'm sure that President Clinton wasn't happy about reading that story. But 3 months or 4 months later, on national television, Senator Fred Thompson had in his hand that document with Bill Clinton's handwriting and was ready to hold that document up on national television to express his shock that the White House was a location for, quote, energizing fundraising. But while he was ready to do that, what I was doing was circulating in the Senate caucus room about 25 different newspaper articles about exactly the same topic, with the same headlines, with the same everything, to every reporter about to cover Senator Fred Thompson. And all I had to say to the reporters was, just in case you guys forget, you already wrote this story, old news, been there, done that. Well, poor Senator Thompson recognized that by the time he was in with his big headline story, most reporters had left the hearing room because they're not going to rewrite the same story. And he recognized over time that our strategy was working because tell it all, tell it early, tell it yourself, gets the bad facts out early, and you're done with the story. The story doesn't dribble on for a long time, and that's, of course, crisis mismanagement, not crisis management. At one point, I've come to know Senator Thompson since he left the Senate, and actually we've become friends. He told me how frustrated he was every time we did one of our preemptive strikes because he knew perfectly well we were taking the steam out of his breaking of the news story. But there was one moment of some high comedy when Senator Thompson actually said, "Today we're going to talk about a topic that is brand new, that even Lanny Davis won't say is old news." I said, "I've done it." So that was a great moment. So let me switch to the topic of more seriousness, which I tell in the book. And in the last chapter of my book, I make myself the object of some ridicule and scorn, but I did it myself. So tell it all, tell it early, tell it yourself. And that is where I found myself reading a New York Times story on December 30th, 2010, about this terrible person who'd gone over to the, quote, dark side. That's the phrase the Times used because somebody had used that expression. Because as I read, this person represented some fairly bad clients, including the defeated President of the Ivory Coast, who is in the bunkers organizing bloodshed to hold on to office. And as the article was written, it was about this person willing to defend this former president who was responsible for a lot of bloodshed in not giving up office. And as I read the story, I kept thinking, you know, this is such a one-sided, terrible, harmful story. I feel so bad for this person. He really needs a good crisis manager. And I realized, wait a minute, I'm the guy they're writing about. I was my own crisis manager, and I did a really lousy job because the story was not true, but I never had a chance, as I teach my clients, to tell it early, tell it all, tell it yourself. Now, I was under very great restrictions, as I write in my chapter, because I was actually working with the U.S. State Department and the White House to get safe passage of this individual out of the Ivory Coast to avoid bloodshed. And I found myself, in the 10 days that I did this awful job, in all of this pain, that I couldn't tell the truth because the whole point was trying to get this guy out. And when I was asked to facilitate a call to him, I never talked to the man. I represented the embassy in Washington. To facilitate a call from the President of the United States, Barack Obama, to this man in his bunker to convince him that we'll give you safe passage to avoid bloodshed in a civil war in the Ivory Coast. How could I tell it all, tell it early, tell it yourself, without revealing my back behind the scenes role in trying to help the President and the State Department get this guy out? But by the time I finally realized this is hopeless, I'm getting killed on the internet, I'm being accused of defending this guy, I can't defend myself, and then the New York Times wrote a story where I couldn't, in the defense of the Times, I couldn't tell them the truth, I couldn't follow my own advice, because I was under a restriction to try to get this guy out quietly without anyone knowing what I was doing. I finally resigned the job. I was surrounded by my grandchildren and my oldest son, who is a journalist, a very famous journalist named Seth Davis, you may see on television during the NCAA tournament. My son Seth said, "Dad, you got to get out because you can't defend yourself from all this internet attack that was really pretty horrible." So I resigned. I tried to get the truth out after the Times story was written, which generated about 10 million stories all over the internet and social media about me defending this person when I wasn't. And I ended up in a lot of pain and suffering in terms of just personal regret that I didn't follow my own rules. The name of the chapter in Crisis Tales is A Fool for a Client, which is the old expression, any lawyer that represents himself has a fool for a client. The good news is that I wrote this book to teach these rules, including where I didn't follow my own rules, so I could teach everybody else. And what I want to end up with is the important topic that I think everybody needs to think about. What do we do in the age of the internet when a lie goes viral, or let's say not intentional, which is what a lie is, but simply a false statement goes viral in seconds on Twitter, on Facebook, on the internet blogosphere? What do you do with search engines that keep that lie eternal in an echo chamber that it's almost impossible to defeat? Because after the story was written about me, I went into my crisis management mode. I called a reporter. I called the State Department. The State Department issued a public statement by its official spokesman, P.J. Crowley, thanking Lanny Davis for all that I did for the cause of avoiding bloodshed. I put that out on unfortunately, New Year's Day morning, which is when nobody reads anything, but it was the morning after the Times story. I did my best to get that out into the internet world of the search engine to intercept the falsehoods, so that at least I would have a record. And it didn't seem to matter. So when I wrote the final chapter of the book, I came up with a concept that all of you should think about and your audience here at the Commonwealth Club. In today's age, it's different than when you had a 24-hour news cycle with print journalism. Now, in a matter of seconds, misinformation goes out and it gets metastasizes throughout the world. And when you type in my name on Google, it pops up. And when I try to intercept the echo chamber with facts, it's difficult to overcome all of the repetition. As I said in the very early part of this commentary, the repetition of a falsehood enough times becomes a perception of truth. So here's my advice. I likened it to a swarm of bees. At the end of my book, I wrote about what it feels like to have bees swarming around your head for whatever reason. Maybe there's honey in your hair. And what do? If you swat at the bees, they just get madder. You may kill a few. I liken that to putting a few facts out to kill a few of the bees. But the rest of the bees just swarm. In fact, they even get angrier. So when clients come to me who have been smeared or distorted on the internet and ask me, what do I do? It's my reputation. People Google my name and they think bad of me. If it's a business, my brand is being hurt. There's an organized petition boycotting my company. We read about these things. It is today's reality on the internet. And the only answer I can give, it's not a real hopeful one, is don't give up. Truth and fairness matters. Don't yield. Sooner or later, if you fight back with the facts, you'll be intercepting that echo chamber enough times that people will catch up and say, oops, all of this internet stuff is wrong. And when it came time to dedicating Crisis Tales, I've always dedicated the two other books I wrote to my wife, who, especially when it comes to crisis management, I always say my wife, Carolyn, who's the best crisis manager of all, putting up with me. But in this case, I did not dedicate this book to Carolyn. I certainly said in my acknowledgments that she's still the best crisis manager I know. But I dedicated this book to truth and fairness, especially on the internet, challenging every journalist, every blogger, every person who posts a tweet in anger or emotion without having a fact behind the attack. And it's a lot if you follow Twitter. Think twice about the power of the lie going viral and innocent people and reputations being forever stained because you had a moment of attack emotion. So I don't know if I'm out of time, but I would like to end with a more uplifting story about my two friends who my oldest son says, Dad, you're the only person on the planet who can claim that you're friends with both Bill Clinton and George Bush. I'm proud that I am. So my final story is an experience that occurred in the White House that may give you some hope that with all the bile and vitriol that you read on the internet, that you see in Washington that has stagnated, even worse than stagnated, has made our government dysfunctional, where Republicans and Democrats can't even be seen talking in a friendly way without getting criticized by the more extreme members of their party. I attended a White House function in April or May of 2004 when President and Mrs. Clinton were invited by the Bushes to come back for the official unveiling of their White House portraits. The room was filled with Clintonistas, former staff members, supporters of Bill Clinton, not big fans of George Bush. And I was a little bit nervous, more than a little, that there was actually the hate word being used about President Bush rather than the disagree word, the hate word. And I thought that the atmosphere in the room was really potentially explosive if somebody booed or hissed when President Bush came into the room. So he and Laura Bush and President Mrs. Clinton came into the room. There was silence. It was the East Room, beautiful, sun-drenched May Day in 2004. And President Bush took the podium, and the air was very tense because of the hostility a lot of people felt towards President Bush and his policies. And he looked down at the Clintons right about this far, and he said, President, Mrs. Clinton, welcome home. You've brought light and energy to this house for the 8 years you were here, and the country misses you. The graciousness and personal way that George Bush spoke directly to Bill and Hillary Clinton broke the tension, and the entire room stood up and gave George Bush a standing ovation. Then when it was Bill Clinton's turn, he looked down at George Bush, people from very different places, from different spots on the ideological spectrum, strong disagreements, and he said, I'm almost quoting him directly, President Bush, Mrs. Bush, Hillary and I would like to thank you for the graciousness of the way you've welcomed us back here. And I'd like to say to everyone in this room, and he was aware of some of the feelings in the room towards President Bush, and to everybody listening, that wouldn't it be nice in American politics if we could stop using words of good versus evil and simply use words of right versus wrong, agree versus disagree. Wouldn't that be a better way to have a conversation to find a consensus? And in my words, I thought, wouldn't it be a better way to govern this country without people throwing food at each other rather than trying to actually solve people's problems? So as usual, Bill Clinton and George Bush together from different places on the political spectrum taught me an important lesson about the need for us to have a different kind of politics in this country that actually, despite disagreements that are real and genuine, allows Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives to actually find solutions to the country's problems. Thank you all very much.
Our thanks to Lanny Davis, former legal counsel to President Bill Clinton and author of the new book, Crisis Tales, Five Rules for Coping with Crisis in Business, Politics, and Life. It is time now for our audience question period, and we have an awful lot of them. And so I'm ready to begin. Just a quick comment on your closing remarks. We had some speakers here, authors of a book called The President's Club. And it's a fascinating read if anyone hasn't read it. But there actually is, you may want to comment on this, there actually is a building near the White House, a home, and a place where the former presidents meet, confer, help one another with particularly helping the current president, whoever that might be, with the duties of the presidency. Are you familiar with that? I'm sure you are, Lance.
Yes. It's a great tradition, and very few people recognize the importance of that club. I know that President Clinton thinks very highly of President Bush and vice versa. President Clinton and President Bush's dad, President Bush 41, got to be so close when they were raising money for a tsunami and other things that was President Bush 43's idea that there's almost a father-son love relationship. And this Wednesday night, I went to the Nixon Library for the first time. And as I walked in, I looked up, and there was a quotation spoken at President Nixon's funeral service by President Bill Clinton about the wisdom and the greatness of Richard Nixon. Despite mistakes and a terrible outcome to the ending of his presidency, President Clinton was willing to focus on what was great about Richard Nixon. So it did remind me of the President's Club hopefully does transcend the partisanship that we see in Washington today.
Well, Mr. Davis, before we start asking questions about subjects in your book and subjects that you didn't cover, because you can't talk about everyone, I was wondering about this question myself as I read the book. How do you protect the confidentiality and privacy rights of the clients whose stories you share in the book? Are there ethical issues that you consider when choosing to share these stories? I mean, is it as simple as having them sign a release, or how does that work?
Very, very glad that question is asked, because the answer is I, over and over again, went over every word that I wrote to take out not only what is called attorney-client privileged advice, which I'm never allowed to reveal, but anything that was close to sensitivity or confidentiality that might lead even slightly to the embarrassment of the person who I was writing about. But it was a decision not to share or seek permission ahead of time, because then it would be inevitable when you ask, you must say yes if a person wants to edit, correct, And I felt this should be my work, and it would have to stand on its own. Now, full disclosure, I could have written some chapters that made clients look bad, because the outcome was pretty bad. Out of loyalty to those clients, I did not do that. So I chose happy ending stories. Not necessarily happy ending that the outcome was good for the client. I write about Congressman Charles Rangel, who made a lot of mistakes in financial disclosures and paying back taxes that I said in the chapter and in the heading of the chapter. The one thing people don't believe in Washington are two words, innocent mistake. So every chapter that I wrote from Martha Stewart not being guilty of insider trading, not even being charged with insider trading, but convicted in the headlines of insider trading, that I told the story of Martha Stewart. Had her name been Susan Smith, in my opinion, which I have a right to, she never would have been indicted. One of my favorite stories is Trent Lott. When it was too late, he'd already done a joke about Strom Thurmond. Maybe he should have been elected president when Strom Thurmond was celebrating his 100th birthday, and that was basically the end of his ability to serve as majority leader in the Senate. He was already down and out, thinking of resigning his position in the Senate, when I got a phone call from a very dear friend, no longer with us, Representative, former Secretary of HUD, Jack Kemp, and great quarterback. And Jack said, please take a call from Trent Lott. He needs your help. I said, it's too late for me to do crisis management for Senator Lott, but I'd be happy to talk to him. And Senator Lott, in the bottom of his political career, said, Reverend Jesse Jackson just called me. Should I take his call? And I said, absolutely, but let me call him first just to be sure. So I called Jesse Jackson, who was an old friend of mine since his heroic civil rights days with Dr. King. And I said, what's up with your call to Senator Lott? And Jesse said, I'm ministering. I'm reaching out. This man is hurting. I said, okay, that's what I thought. I'll tell Senator Lott to make the call. But by the way, Jesse, I'd like to come over to be there when the call comes in. Reverend Jackson said to me, Lanny, does that mean you don't trust me? And I said, I love you, but I'm coming over to be there when the call is made. And the call came in while I was sitting there. And he's a truly great man, a spiritual man, who doesn't think about politics when someone is hurting and needs the ministering of a minister, which is what Reverend Jackson is. And so he said many things to Senator Lott that I won't repeat, but finally he said, okay, Senator, I forgive you. Let us pray. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, what am I doing here? What should I do? So as Reverend Jackson is praying for Senator Trent Lott, I just bowed my head. And I thought to myself, someday I'm going to write this story. Trent Lott was healed by that process. I had a minor role in that healing. He and I have become close friends to this day. It's why I wrote the chapter, because sometimes crisis management isn't about solving a crisis. It's about personal healing, which is what happened with Trent Lott.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Lanny Davis, former legal counsel to President Bill Clinton, who was discussing how to best deal with crisis in business, politics, and life. You can also find a video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. I wanted to go to Martha Stewart just for a moment. That was the first part of your book. And as you said, Martha Stewart did not get convicted of insider trading, but she did get accused and convicted of making false statements. And the thought crossed my mind, is that, other than terrible judgment by President Clinton while in the White House, is that also something similar to what he was convicted of?
Well, in the world of public opinion, President Clinton was untruthful about a topic that is highly sensitive, that usually, if it weren't about a person in public life, would be a matter between a spouse and a companion. And in President Clinton's case, that played out in public. It plays out in many other instances in public life. The American people, myself included, don't forgive that behavior. Rather, don't defend that behavior, but we do forgive that behavior because we all know that we all have human weaknesses, and there but for the grace is the scripture teaching about we are all sinners. But I also have great faith in the wisdom and fairness of the American people in being able to distinguish serious personal weaknesses that led to that situation with performance in office, which is what we expect presidents to do. So at the end of the Clinton presidency, despite everything, on his last day in office, he had a 65% job approval rating, the highest approval rating of any second-term president since polling was invented. So I guess my answer is, yes, there was a judgment made by the American people, most people, that what he did was wrong, personally, but a matter more between him and his wife than anybody else. His stating untruths, falsehoods, was wrong, and he took a terrible consequence for those mistakes. But at the end of the day, as I guess the old expression goes, look at him now. What a truly great man around the world. And my friend Hillary isn't so bad either. So he survived a terrible ordeal, and I'm very proud of his presidency.
We have many questions on gun control. Since the Senate failed to pass the recent gun control legislation, do you feel that there might be a line in front of your office consisting of senators coming up for re-election one of these days seeking your advice? It so happens that if some of you, as I did, read the San Francisco Chronicle this morning, there was a lead story in the business section. It was really quite interesting, and it was an article by a local and a legendary tech investor. His name is Ron Cowan, and he is giving notice to dozens of U.S. senators. It turns out there's, I think, at least 40, maybe a few more, who rejected expanded background checks on firearm sales in spite of what apparently is overwhelming public opinion in support of the measure. Ron Conway stated that he would employ the most sophisticated social media campaign, and this is to get to your point about the Internet today, ever mounted to remove over 40 senators from office. It is probably doubtful, the article went on to say, that he could do this, but we would love to get your viewpoint on the issue.
Well, on the merits, I completely agree there should be background checks. I have a lot of company, 80% of the American people. You don't get 80% in any poll. Motherhood and apple pie would have 20% dissenting. Republicans, NRA members, conservatives support background checks. So on the merits, the gentleman's entitled to hold people accountable who he disagrees with on such an important issue as gun control. But what I would look as a crisis manager and communications advisor is that the word is framing. How do you state the issue in a way that gets you the most impact? And to me, it's not about arguing whether background checks are good or bad. I would reframe the whole thing and say it's about the right to have an up or down vote, the right to have the Senate vote yes or no. The vote that just occurred, which this gentleman misses the mark by leaping over, is a responsibility of both parties and the hypocrisy of the filibuster. Both parties have invested their own political interests in making 60 votes what you need in a democracy to pass legislation. So the vote that occurred yesterday was a vote to prevent a vote. Because 54 senators supported the right to vote, you needed 60. I would frame to the American people, people have a right to vote against background checks if they want to. I think they're wrong. But everybody should be voting one way or the other. And let me remind my fellow Democrats that when George Bush was president, we denied the right to an up or down vote all the time by requiring 60 votes. Many times about judicial nominees, and everybody says, well, that's different. No, it isn't. A majority is a majority is a majority. The Senate should be allowed to vote. So, by the way, the latest vote count on actually being allowed to vote on this legislation is 70. So 54 wasn't enough to allow that 70 to vote. That's the way I would frame the issue. And then I think you'd get much more traction with even people who are afraid of background checks for privacy reasons or NRA members, because even they would say there should be an up or down vote, and let's see what happens.
Sex scandals. They're prevalent in politics. We've never heard of that. That's right. Everywhere you turn, historically and currently, we read about sex scandals. So here's three people that you didn't talk about in your book, but I'll say them slowly because you may have to go back a little bit in recent history to formulate your answer. And there's quite a commonality and some questions about each of these three. Dick Morris, Anthony Weiner, who is now trying to throw his hat in the ring, I guess, to run for the mayor of New York, and former governor of New York, who has spoken at the Commonwealth Club, Elliot Spitzer. Can you comment on these three, and do you have any advice? Would you have had any advice had you been hired by them?
So is there another question anyone?
We've got lots of questions.
You know, this is really not a crisis manager speaking. This is a human being who feels other people's pain. Bill Clinton was often ridiculed for that sentence, but it's for real. I have a very good friend sitting in the front row, Bill Alderman from Orrick Herrington, a great lawyer, but also a friend of Hillary when her name was Rodham. And you can only feel empathy for what happened to Bill Clinton on a human level. And since I was a friend of Hillary's, I felt her hurt as well. Anthony Weiner, I think is the right, or is it Weiner, is married to a tremendous lady who works for Hillary, Huma Abedin. And the two of them suffered when this happened. And you could say that about Elliot Spitzer and many, many others. So as a human being, this is a terrible thing to be played out in public. It's bad enough when it happens when it's in private and your spouse and your companion feels betrayed, much less in public where the humiliation is just beyond comprehension. So I guess my answer is the advice I would give to anyone in this situation is there but for the grace. I can't tell you what to do on something like this. I can only tell you is do your best to make peace at home. You owe a big apology to the public that voted for you, and you should do that quickly. But as I said to Trent Lott, the real issue is your being able to heal and move on. And one thing I would say about Elliot Spitzer, who's a friend, and Bill Clinton, who's a friend, is I just was in great admiration that however badly they acted and mistakenly they acted, they moved on and kept their lives and their families together. So that's a very personal answer.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, towards the end of the book, you talk about being hired by the office of the president of Penn State University, I didn't realize what a large institution it was. I believe you stated 100,000 students and 24 campuses. So that's rivals the University of California, we're all familiar with here. That's a big place. And it was quite emotional to me when you described how they removed the statue of Coach Joe Paterno. I don't want to put my words into the question so much, but can you talk about the Penn State experience and Joe Paterno and just give us your gut feeling about that whole issue?
Yes, I was retained by the president, replacement of the prior president, of Penn State, Rod Erickson, a truly great man, a man who never ceased to amaze me at his fortitude, honesty, courage, because he was under tremendous pressure to restore the good name of Joe Paterno and certainly to rename the stadium after Joe Paterno and certainly not to take down the statue. And I wasn't there to repudiate or criticize a truly great man who had made Penn State in many ways the university that it is. Joe Paterno established the standard of the student athlete, demanded that his football players do well in class as well as on the field. And I wasn't there to tear down the real achievements that could never be changed. But there was a fact that he himself said to the Washington Post in an interview, which is, when he learned about the rape of a child. And there's no question that he learned about it because he told a grand jury under oath that he knew there was sexual conduct involving fondling, involving Jerry Sandusky and a young boy in a shower on a Friday night alone. There's no dispute. He testified to that under oath before a grand jury. And then he said that he phoned a day after he learned about this, the athletic director, which was his legal obligation, and reported that. And that's all for 10 years. While Jerry Sandusky brought children onto the campus, raped them, brought them onto the football field, and what is called in the world of internet and pedophile predators, groomed these children so that he could do his evil, awful, monstrous deeds. So I wasn't there to criticize or defend Joe Paterno. I was there to get the story out. That's what I do for a living, get the facts out, let people decide. So all I did was to quote Joe Paterno's own words when he said to a reporter for the Washington Post, "I should have done more." Then the Board of Trustees was advised by attorneys, "You can't tell why you fired Joe Paterno because you're being sued by the victims and their families, and you're in the middle of a criminal investigation." So I had to persuade my fellow lawyers, which is what I do for a living. I'm in the room with the lawyers with attorney-client privilege, and I have to persuade my fellow lawyers there's something more important than winning the litigation at issue here. It's called Penn State and the brand and what it means to not just the 100,000 students, but the 500,000 alumni and many other people. So what we ended up doing with two New York Times reporters in a little conference room in Teterboro, New Jersey, is to put around the table the members of the Board of Trustees who were finally released, liberated by me, to tell the truth about their feelings when they had to do this anguished, difficult decision to remove this icon who they loved, Joe Paterno. And as each one told the story, all that you heard was anguish. And there wasn't a dry eye in the room at times when they told their stories of how they reached that decision, including, I have to say, both New York Times reporters teared up at one point. That's what I did for Penn State, is just let people decide for themselves about Joe Paterno, but understand how difficult the decision, people who loved someone had to make this awful decision to remove him, and how Rod Erickson, the president of Penn State, was able to make the courageous decision to take that statue down because that was the only way, in a crisis management sense, to move on and not have that constantly be a reminder of that crisis. I, by the way, had nothing to do with his decision on that statue. I was gone by then. That was pure the integrity of Rod Erickson.
And by the way, you go on to say in that chapter that the library at Penn State University still has the name of Coach Paterno.
So the moral compass of Rod Erickson was never to hesitate that what happened with Joe Paterno, in his own words, he should have done more, and that children were raped on the Penn State campus. And he also distinguished the great contribution that couldn't be erased that Joe Paterno made to the school in standing for the important principle of the student-athlete. So he made the decision, you take the statue down in front of the stadium, because that was a symbol going forward that needed to be removed, but you don't take away the honor in the library name of all that he achieved for Penn State. Having no credit involved in that decision, I wrote in my book, this was the ultimate statement of what a truly great man this Rod Erickson is.
We often hear the comment when it comes to jury trials or trials in general that the defendants should not testify and are not allowed to testify on their own behalf. Going back to Martha Stewart's chapter just for a moment, you state, Mr. Davis, that Martha Stewart is one of the world's best communicators, yet her hired attorney, Robert Morelos, had a decision to not let Martha Stewart testify on her own behalf. Do you disagree or agree with that decision by Morelos?
Well, I suggest in the wisdom of hindsight, she was convicted anyway of a false statement, by the way, not under oath with no transcript. So all the headlines about Martha Stewart was he was guilty of insider trading. It's not that she wasn't convicted of insider trading. She wasn't even indicted. She was indicted for making a false statement, not under oath, from the notes of the agents or investigators, and with no transcript. So that's why I think, if she's convicted anyway with the wisdom of hindsight, had she turned to the jury and said, look, I may have made a mistake, and when I said I couldn't remember something, that was the false statement, by the way, can't remember. But I don't think I should be sitting here in the dock because of, at the very moment when I was in the middle of being accused of insider trading on all the media and everybody was coming at me, I made a mistake. Now, does the jury convict if she turns to the jury and says that? Who knows? I don't say Bob Morvillo was a great lawyer. I'm not a criminal lawyer. I think most criminal lawyers would agree with the decision that they had a weak case. Don't put her on the stand and you're going to get an acquittal. The wisdom of hindsight, she was convicted. I think she was convicted because of all the poisonous and very prejudicial publicity and leaks that occurred that led to her being convicted in the headlines, which is why I got brought in by Martha to at least tell her story, which was written in the New Yorker by Jeffrey Toobin, that she was not guilty of insider trading, and it turned out she wasn't even indicted for that.
So I'm going to add my own tale onto this, one of these two final questions here. What do you do if you morally disagree with the wrongdoings of your client? But my tale to that question is, what do you do if you know your client has lied and has not come to be truthful to you, and if they've really made an egregious affront on the law? Not something like Martha Stewart, where there is an open question, and there are several open questions, I think, with some of the clients that you have in your book, but someone who really is very, very guilty, in your opinion.
I only speak as a lawyer because I have two hats. They used to say at the White House I was a walking conflict of interest. One hat is as a lawyer. I have canons of ethics. I chose to be a lawyer because I believe in our legal system. Our legal system requires two people arguing both sides, and the truth can only come out with adverse, smart people presenting different views of the facts. That's what our legal system is about. You cannot get justice in America with one side arguing. You can in a dictatorship, but not in America. That means some lawyers have to be willing to argue on behalf of somebody who's a pretty bad character. And anyone who doesn't understand that, doesn't understand the way we get to truth in America, is that legal system. So when I decide to become a lawyer, I buy in to representing people I don't particularly like or agree with or don't want to associate with, because I believe in justice, and justice requires adversity for a jury to decide. So that's my legal answer. My personal answer, and when I'm interviewing young people in law schools, I'm sure my friend Bill Alderman has had this happen to him. So are you telling me that you have to defend Adolf Hitler? Let me think about that. I just was very eloquent telling you you have to, but let me think about that. The answer is, there's got to be a line somewhere in the sky where I say, no, let somebody else do that. Am I compromising my commitment to my ethical requirements? Yes, but I'm not perfect. So I just couldn't defend Richard, I could defend Richard Nixon, but somebody of that level of evil. I said on a recent interview, I couldn't defend Jerry Sandusky. He's pure evil. Let somebody else do that. But I did tell you what the requirement is in the legal system. With my other hat as an advocate on television, which I do some of, and in this audience, I cannot tell a lie. Not only because I don't like telling lies, and my father and mother taught me if I tell a lie, I'll get caught, but I can't be effective if I lie once to the public or to a lawyer or to a reporter if I'm advocating for a client. So my credibility is my asset when I'm doing crisis management and I'm doing television. So the answer is, if a client lies to me, I can't advocate a lie. If my client is evil, I can't advocate evil is not evil. I will not take a client that is evil and ask to be done public advocacy. That's different than the canon of ethics within the legal judicial system. And so when there have been occasions I've been asked to advocate on behalf of someone I consider to be either a liar or evil, I've said no, not just because it violates my moral code. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get away with it. People would know I didn't believe what I was saying.
Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time. Our thanks to Lanny Davis, former legal counsel to President Bill Clinton and author of the new book, Crisis Tales, Five Rules for Coping with Crisis in Business, Politics, and in Life.
Thank you all.
We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. And we want to remind everyone that copies of Mr. Davis's book are on sale in the lobby and that he'll be pleased to sign them in the room following the program. I am Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.